evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Thursday, August 24, 2017. The UN Chief of Peacekeeping Operations tells the Security Council things have not improved in South Sudan.
While efforts by the SPLA to take PAGAC, the SPLA IO, de facto headquarters, initially succeeded, fighting around PAGAC and along the corridor to Machiang continues, and civilians in the area remain displaced.
And the head of JMAC admits South Sudan is not implementing the peace deal.
We demand the total cessation of violence around the country and a commitment by all parties and groups to pursue a political path to reconciling their differences. We further urge all parties to the peace agreement to facilitate access to citizens to conduct their work.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. A UN Security Council briefing on South Sudan today focused largely on the country's security situation and efforts to revive the 2015 peace deal. Assistant Secretary General for Peacekeeping Operations, Al-Qasim Wani, told the council that due to stepped-up fighting in some areas, the UN mission in South Sudan has enhanced its presence in Torit, and peacekeepers have continued intense patrolling in and around Yei. When he said aid workers continue to encounter dangerous conditions in South Sudan.
In the month of July, 136 access incidents were reported by the humanitarian community. This is the highest number recorded in any one month since December 2013. Of these 136 incidents, 49 involved violence against personnel and assets, once again illustrating the increasingly dangerous and risky environment in which humanitarian actors are operating.
He says those incidents directly affect humanitarian operations, which in turn impact on the most vulnerable population. The South Sudan's permanent representatives to the United Nations, Akwae Bona Malwal, defended his government, saying President Kiir is working to bring peace, including announcing a unilateral ceasefire and a national dialogue.
However, it was not a blank check for the rebels to continue their attacks and provocations on the local population while the army stands aside and watch. These provocations and hit-and-run attacks led to the hot pursuit which resulted in the eventual capture of PAGAC, the headquarters of the rebels, by the South Sudan People's Defense Forces.
Bona insists the country is moving towards peace and stability, but when he told the council members that the security situation in South Sudan continues to be a serious cause for concern, adding that ceasefire remains elusive as military operations continue in Upper Nile region.
While efforts by the SPLA to take PAGAC, the SPLA IO, de facto headquarters, initially succeeded, fighting around PAGAC and along the corridor to Machiang continues, and civilians in the area remain displaced, including some flow of refugees to Ethiopia.
Nicholas Haysom, the special envoy of the United Nations Secretary General to South Sudan, says recent regional initiatives to address the crisis have not led to a breakthrough in the political stalemate.
There is sporadic fighting and widespread insecurity across the country. Our engagements with South Sudanese interlocutors, including the opposition, suggest that battlefield fortunes continue to inform the calculus of both the government and its opponents. Alongside its military pacification efforts, the government has created an appearance of reconciliation inter alia through the limited release of political prisoners. The government has further linked these efforts to the National Dialogue Initiative and to lay the ground for calls for political actors to prepare for elections in 2018.
Haysom warned that the prevailing insecurity situation in South Sudan, the massive displacement of its citizens, and the lack of appropriate institutions could deepen the conflict. The head of the Joint Monitoring and Evaluation Commission, the body tasked with monitoring the implementation of the peace agreement, admits very little has been achieved in the 2 years since the accord was signed. Festus Mohai blames the government forces for most of the ongoing fighting in Upper Nile, as we hear from Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
Festus Mohai held a JEMEC plenary meeting in Juba today with the transitional government of national unity ministers, diplomats, and civil society activists. He acknowledged there has been no meaningful progress on implementing the 2015 peace deal due to a continuous cycle of violence, displacement, and deprivation of humanitarian support over the past year, which has led to untold misery.
The security situation in the former Upper Nile state has worsened due to the recent offensive operations by forces of the SPLA in government against the SPLA in opposition Riek Machar faction in Matiang and Pagak.
The peace deal was supposed to end the fighting and unify the country, but Mohai says the country is still far from achieving peace or stability. He says since fighting flared up in Juba between government forces and soldiers loyal to former First Vice President Riek Machar in July last year, JEMEC has been soaked by the continuous fighting and the rapid deterioration of South Sudan's security, economy, and humanitarian conditions. Mohai says there have been gross human rights abuses, including indiscriminate killings, rape, and the destruction of property across the country. And he says the number of South Sudanese who are severely food insecure continues to rise.
6 million people, half of the entire population, are now severely food insecure. And the continuous displacement from the Equatorial region, the breadbasket of South Sudan, might further increase future food insecurity as cultivation is disrupted.
The UN Refugee Agency says at least 4 million people have been displaced, 2 million internally displaced, and the other 2 million have sought refuge in neighboring countries. Mohai accuses the government of continuing to deny the ceasefire transitional security arrangements monitoring mechanism, or CTSAM, access to conflict areas to do their job, investigate ceasefire violations.
We demand the total cessation of violence around the country and a commitment by all parties and groups to pursue a political path to reconciling their differences. We further urge all parties to the peace agreement to facilitate access to CTSAM to conduct their work.
Both the SPLM in government and SPLM-IO, led by First Vice President Taban Dengai, have repeatedly denied they are violating terms of the peace agreement. Michael Makwe is South Sudan's information minister and government spokesperson.
If we go down to follow the provisions of the agreement, point by point, you will find that we have crossed most of the lines.
The transitional government accuses the international community of imposing some sections of the peace agreement, such as the power-sharing ratios and the redeployment of forces outside of the capital, Juba. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
A South Sudanese diplomat in Washington denies the country's mission in North America is broke. Ambassador Gordon Boy, who is the chargé d'affaires at the South Sudan Embassy in Washington, is refuting reports that local staff and diplomats at the embassy have not received their paychecks since January. Boy claims the embassy pays salaries regularly to all its employees, including diplomats.
In Washington, we have revenue from visas. We are not like other embassies.
Boy, let me ask you one question here. You said you have revenue from visas, but there is a travel advisory for Americans not to travel to South Sudan. So who is traveling to South Sudan? Who is getting visas from you to go to South Sudan?
NGOs are going to South Sudan. Canadians are going to South Sudan. People from the UN are going to South Sudan. That travel advisor was last year and was lifted. We have so many Americans going to South Sudan. South Sudanese Americans are going. Even the non-South Sudanese Americans are also going. So we don't have that problem of visas.
You are telling me the South Sudan Embassy in the United States of America has no money problem.
That is correct.
Financially stable.
Yes, that's what I'm saying, because we have revenue from visas. We are not like other embassies that do not have any revenues. For example, there are embassies that do not have a problem because they get money from revenue. For example, Washington, Nairobi, Kampala. These embassies use the money from the visas to pay our operational costs and also to pay the local staff.
But I have very credible knowledge from local staff who work with you that they have not been paid for 8 months. If you depend on visas as your source of revenue, how come you are not able to pay your local staff for 8 months?
I paid them. I paid the local staff.
When did you last pay them?
I paid them last month with the revenue. Because that's why they are going to work. If you can check, you are in Washington. My local staff, they go to work every day. It's because I paid them from the revenue, from visa money.
How about you? Are you also paying yourself from the visa money?
Well, if there is a critical situation, yes. In case the money, has the salary has not come from you, but yes, we are allowed by our ministry to do that.
But I'm asking you because you have not received your salary for 8 months.
No, I use revenue. I use the visa revenue to pay my rent. I don't have a problem with that. That's why you see me still existing.
How do you survive in a situation where you can only pay your rent? And what about the other needs? I mean, you are a family man, you have your children, and how do you survive for 8 months without a salary?
I survive because of the revenue. Salary is what? Salary is money, right? But we also get money from the revenue. The same revenue we get from the visas is the same money that will survive me because I don't see any difference between the money we get from the revenue and the money that can come from Juba.
But the money from the visa is supposed to be remitted at the Ministry of Finance.
It is the ministry.
It's not supposed to be used by you. You're supposed to send it to Juba.
No, Juba itself that gave her that authorization. It is the Council of Ministers, the same Ministry of Finance with the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. They allowed us to use the revenue in order to make sure that the embassy is functioning properly. So it is the government that allowed us to do that.
What if people stop going to South Sudan? Where will you get money to survive on?
There is no people that will stop going to South Sudan. Also, the government is fixing very soon, within 1 month, the oil production is going up in Paloj. And also, within 1 month, oil fields in former Unity State will resume production.
How many local staff do you have at the embassy in Washington?
We have 11.
And they are all reporting to work?
Yes, for sure. They are reporting to work.
Someone went to the embassy this week and told me that it looks like it's a deserted house, that there are no people there. Most people have gone home because they have not been paid.
No, that's not true.
But have you written to Juba about the conditions of your diplomats, your staff?
No, I cannot write to Juba. While Juba gave us authority to use visa money, we don't have problem of money.
So you are happy staying without salary for 8 months?
I told you we already have salaries from revenue. Because if you have revenue, the same money. The money we get from the revenue is the same money because it is money that can go to the account of the government.
Let me put you on the spot here a little bit. I know people who work at South Sudan Embassy. They have not been paid for 8 months. Why would you send a wrong message here that you are paying them?
John, can you bring anybody from the embassy to be the one talking instead of you? Because you are telling me somebody so-and-so told you this. But so-and-so, I give them the money. If there is anybody contradicting me, okay, bring them to the studio and let them face me. I'm the deputy chief of mission. I'm the one running the finance and administration, and I know that I paid this local staff. They don't have any problem. But if there is somebody telling you that they are not being paid, that person should come and tell me because I have the records.
That's Ambassador Gordon Boy, the Chargé d'Affaires at the South Sudan Embassy in Washington. He was speaking to me from Falls Church, Virginia, earlier today. Russia's ambassador to Sudan was found dead in a swimming pool at his residence in Khartoum on Wednesday. Reuters quotes a spokesman for the Sudanese police who said Mirgayas Siriyanki had history of high blood pressure and he is believed to have died of natural causes. Sudan's foreign ministry expressed its condolences to Russia in a statement hailing Siriyanki's work in Sudan. You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, we take a look at what's being done to reduce Sudan's high maternal mortality rate. We'll bring that story when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
are you where you thought you would be at this point in your life?
I dreamt I have an ambition of being a doctor, but it wasn't complete because of the situations that I was unable to manage to become a doctor. And then I chose to take another profession, which is also part of medical profession.
Yeah, my life is still going on. I've not achieved my goal because I'm a student. I'm a student at Catholic University, a fourth-year student, and I'm remaining with 1 year still. So my future is still on progress. I've not achieved my goal yet.
Not yet, though I have achieved a lot ever since I had my own goals in life. So I am still struggling, but I know I'll make it.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. Sudan's maternal mortality rate are among the highest in the world. The Carter Center, which has worked with the Sudanese people since 1980s to resolve conflict and prevent disease, is partnering with the Sudan government on a five-year plan to improve country's maternal health care. Ayen Bior has more for VOA from Washington.
In 2015, the last year such numbers were available, Sudan had 311 maternal deaths per 100,000 live births. When compared to 216 per 100,000 live births globally, that ratio is alarming, according to Stephen Blount, the Carter Center's Director of Special Health Projects.
Sudan has among the highest maternal mortality rates in the Eastern Mediterranean region of the World Health Organization. That's the reason that the government of Sudan, in asking the Carter Center to assist them, asked that our assistance focus on increasing the number and increasing the competency of health workers devoted to improving maternal and child health.
The Carter Center, a nonprofit NGO founded by former U.S. President Jimmy Carter, is working with Sudan's Federal Ministry of Health and the Qatar Fund for Development on a five-year initiative to increase the skills of healthcare professionals, including midwives, and to update equipment and health protocols in the country. Maternal mortality has improved since 1960, when 744 mothers died out of 100,000 live births in Sudan. Blount says the decline is due in part to increased availability of health care in rural areas.
Another reason that the effort has improved is the availability of treatment, supplies, medications, and so on are increasingly being focused in the rural areas where the problem is the greatest.
The Carter Center says the goal is to train 265 faculty and 10,000 midwives and community health care workers over the next 5 years.
There are four elements of the project. One is to upgrade and modernize the curriculum for the training of those health workers, one. The second is increasing the skills of local Sudanese instructors in these schools of nursing and midwifery. So a train-the-trainers effort so that they can become more self-reliant in terms of teaching and using more modern pedagogical skills.
Blount says improving the learning environment with updated equipment, as well as monitoring and evaluating the program, are two other elements to the project. Under the Carter Center initiative, 50 Sudanese healthcare institutions are expected to improve their ability to train future healthcare workers, with the hope that new curriculum will translate into a marked decline in maternal mortality across Sudan. Ayen Bior for VOA News, Washington.
From Sudan, we move to Cameroon, where the world's largest non-governmental hospital ship docked in Cameroon's commercial capital, Douala. Medical staff and volunteers from around the world plan to provide nearly 3,000 free surgeries on the ship over the next 10 months. Muki Edwin Kinzeka reports for VOA from Douala that local healthcare gaps remain enormous.
15 patients board the Africa Mercy. Bernadette Abudjo traveled 600 kilometers from eastern Cameroon. Her two children suffer from club foot. She says she brought them here because she has been told that they will get free operations. She says she is very grateful because she does not have the money to take the children to the hospital. Clubfoot is just one of many ailments for which little surgical treatment is available in Cameroon. The Ministry of Health reports that the country has just 4,200 medical doctors for a population of 23 million, and only about half are practicing. This ambulance rushed to the Yaoundé General Hospital last month to find hundreds of patients suffering kidney defects blocking the hospital entrance. They said they had not received treatment for 2 months. Their leader, Alois Ovidi, said almost all equipment was broken. He says the government has not been fulfilling its promises, even though it is aware 32 people living with kidney defects had died in less than 2 months. He says others can no longer walk because only 8 of the 17 dialysis machines at the General Hospital in Yaoundé are functioning. He says instead of the 4 hours of treatment, patients are receiving just 3. Outside the 2 main cities of Yaoundé and Douala, quality medical care is even harder to find. The Ministry of Health says the majority of the population relies instead of traditional healers. Cameroon's health minister, André Mamafuda, told VOA only 7% of the national budget is allocated for health care.
Les prévisions montrent qu'un pays qui accorde 15% de son budget.
He says raising that allocation to 15% would enable the country to develop the health sector, including infrastructure and surgical equipment. He says many more people should have access to health care, but unfortunately, the country has many other development priorities and only limited resources. Back in the waters of Douala, flags fly on the Africa Mercy, the gigantic white vessel housing Mercy Ship's mobile hospital. The flags represent some of the 40 nationalities of the medical staff and volunteers on board. Wari Blackburn is the managing director of Mercy Ships. The U.S.-based charity has operated hospital ships in developing nations since 1978.
About 3,000 people from Cameroon we're hoping to help surgically. In addition, we are also planning to help with the training of nurses and doctors and other healthcare professionals.
She said they have selected the patients on the basis of need, focusing on surgeries that cannot be performed in local hospitals for lack of equipment and qualified staff. Such surgeries include tumor removal and repair of hernias, obstetric fistulas, cleft palates, and cataracts. The government of Cameroon is providing transportation, lodging, and food for patients and their families while they receive care. Mercy Ships hopes to train 1,000 local health care workers to do follow-up care and help other patients before the ship raises anchor in June 2018. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Douala, Cameroon.
Global climate change continues to increase, and with it, the number and severe droughts that kills trees. That in turn contributes to global warming. But how exactly do droughts kill trees, and can the death of trees and forests be predicted? A new report in the journal Nature, Ecology and Evolution looks at these questions. VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with plant biologist Henry Adams of Oklahoma University. Professor Adams led a team of 62 scientists who conducted the study.
We really want to know what it takes to kill a tree. It's obvious if you don't have water, that eventually a tree will die. But how do we know when it's been enough stress that that will result in death? How do we predict that? The idea is that if we know how trees die, then we might be able to better predict when they will die. And so the goal of the study was to bring together data from a number of experiments and other studies, and let's look at this as one whole picture altogether and see what it tells us about how trees die.
Now, this is of particular relevance now, isn't it? Or increasing relevance, I should say, as climate change and worse and more frequent droughts make themselves felt, correct?
That's right. In the last couple decades, there's been widespread tree mortality now documented on, you know, every continent where you find trees, where you see whole forests turning brown and dying.
Is this happening in Africa too?
Yes, it is, such as with Atlas cedar in Algeria. And I believe you can find some woody plants in South Africa where this has happened as well.
So how do trees die from drought?
Well, one thing that's pretty obvious is the lack of water, right? That's a problem. And what's a tree normally doing in regards to water? Trees don't have pumps, right? They don't pump their water from the roots to the leaves. They have to depend on just a natural pull from the atmosphere on the water, and the water moves from the soil through the roots up the stems into the leaves. You can think of the tension of water moving from the soil to the leaves like a rope of water being pulled out of the plant. And if there's a lot of pulling on the other end because it's very dry, tension will increase. If there's not enough supply in the soil, that tension will also increase. And that can literally break the system by which trees move water.
And of course, there would naturally be more pulling from the atmosphere through the plant when the air is very warm and dry, as in a drought, right?
Right. You can form a bubble in the stem of a tree that blocks the flow of water. That's one way that we look at how trees die in drought.
I understand that trees actually have pores, which they close during droughts to retain water. But that strategy can hasten death in another way. Can you explain how that works?
So I explained that dangerous situation where the atmosphere is sort of pulling harder and harder and could cause problems. And so what trees can do to avoid that problem is to close these pores by which water leaves the leaves. The problem is trees need carbon that's in the air in the form of carbon dioxide to carry out photosynthesis. So photosynthesis, we're talking about trees taking carbon out of the atmosphere and making their own food. They use the energy from the sun to do this. Now, water leaves through these pores called stomata. Carbon comes in through these pores. So if you close the pores, the carbon can't get in, so they can't make their food. If that goes on for long enough, they might simply starve from not being able to make enough food for themselves.
That was Oklahoma State University plant biologist Henry Adams. He spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips in New York via Skype. And that brings us to the end of our show for this Thursday. We now leave you with the song Yala Kitautu by Victoria Ole.
Yala Kitautu,
Yala
Kitautu,
Yala Yala.
Yala Kitautu,
Yala
Kitautu,
Yala
Yala. Kelly ni Nigeria,
Yala
ni Nigeria,
Yala Yala.
Kelly ni Nigeria,
Yala
ni Nigeria,
Yala.
We've been listening to Victoria Ole with the song Yala Kitautu. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening. We would like to hear what you think about this show. Our email is southsudan@voanews.com. You can also visit us on our Facebook page, South Sudan in Focus. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. My